Zero HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, coming up next. First, it's the Global Citizen International Digest with Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov, and then an interview with the President and CEO of the Urban League of Portland, Nkenge Harmon Johnson.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Bargaining with the devil in the Middle East. The United States and Israel are desperate to bring about a normalization of relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Naturally, each of the three parties has conditions, each has a certain amount of leverage, and each has options in case the goal can't be met. And it just might be that a deal contains ingredients that should make it untouchable. To normalize relations with Israel, Saudi Arabia is demanding access to uranium enrichment technology and a U.S. security guarantee, presumably against a threat from Iran, despite their having only recently concluded a normalization agreement. Israel wants to normalize relations with the Saudis as a means of gaining legitimacy and driving a wedge between the Saudis and Iran, as well as those Arab countries that don't recognize Israel. The U.S. sees normalization as a major diplomatic victory for Middle East peace, but is insisting that Israel make concessions to the Palestinians as a condition of supporting normalization. One report says the Palestinian Authority has communicated to the Saudis that it wants more control over parts of the occupied West Bank, reopening of the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, which was closed under Trump at Israeli insistence, and resumption of Saudi funding. Now for the clinkers. First, facilitating Saudi Arabia's acquisition of nuclear technology and uranium, it has none, risks it someday deciding to go nuclear with a bomb, which might lead other Middle East countries, such as the United Arab Emirates, to do the same. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman once said Saudi Arabia would build a bomb if Iran did. He cannot be trusted to sign onto or abide by international inspection of nuclear power plants once built. Second, for the U.S. to provide security guarantees to an authoritarian government such as the Saudis seems more than a step too far. Why secure a murderous, repressive regime, and against whom? Third, Saudis indicate that if they can't get nuclear technology from the Americans, they'll turn to China. Should the U.S. succumb to such blackmail? Fourth, the current right-wing government of Benjamin Netanyahu seems highly unlikely to make any kind of concessions to the Palestinians, no matter how attractive normalization with Saudi Arabia might be. If anything, his government is doing all it can to stifle Palestinian voices, oust them from their land, and end their dream of a separate state. Fifth, normalizing Saudi-Israeli relations might doom the recently negotiated improvement in Saudi Arabia's relations with Iran. Two specialists write, quote, "If Saudi Arabia embraces Israel, Iran will likely throw everything but the kitchen sink at the Saudis. It will more aggressively challenge the kingdom's legitimacy as leader of the Muslim world and most probably threaten its very security," unquote. The writers recall Iran's attack on Saudi oil fields in 2019 in response to Saudi policy in Yemen. In short, Israel-Saudi Arabia normalization at first seems like a marvelous strategic idea, but actually it has nightmare implications. It certainly does not serve the cause of human rights, holds out the potential for more rather than fewer nuclear-capable states in the Middle East, and might put the U.S. in the unenviable position of protecting an autocrat whom President Biden once called a pariah. A meeting of foreign ministers causes a crisis. Another idea for normalizing Israel's relations with an Arab country has come to naught, this time with Libya. In contrast with Israel's newly established diplomatic relations with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco, Israel does not have relations with Libya, whose divided government remains in a shambles, only partly recognized internationally since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. So when the foreign ministers of Libya and Israel held what was supposed to be a secret meeting in Rome late in August, it produced outrage in Libya and sharp criticism in Israel. Libya's internationally recognized government was attacked by its other unrecognized half for meeting with the devil. The foreign minister had to flee to Turkey. The prime minister suspended her. Demonstrations took place in several cities, and the government tried to calm things by insisting that the Rome meeting was informal and unplanned. Israel's foreign minister was taken to task by the political opposition and the U.S. for boasting of a diplomatic coup that wasn't, and for putting Libya's minister in danger. Another example of the sensitivity of Arab-Israeli relations. Canada's wildfires, a global catastrophe. Writing in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Gary Sacrifage, a Canadian environmental specialist, points out that the country's managed forests, once a carbon sink, for the last 22 years have emitted more carbon than they have absorbed, and this year's wildfires have produced extraordinary carbon numbers. Quote, "This year's coast-to-coast wildfires in Canada have already emitted an estimated 1.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide. That's triple the annual climate pollution from burning fossil fuels in Canada. It's more than the combined emissions from 100 nations, and there are still months of fire seasons looming ahead," unquote. To make the point even sharper, the author states that all vehicles would have to be taken off Canada's roads in order to make up for those emissions. In other news, the U.S. and China agreed to regularize commercial talks. The latest U.S. diplomatic journey to Beijing produced some mildly good news. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo reached agreement with her Chinese counterpart to hold annual meetings on trade and related matters. Quote, she said, "I think it's a very good sign that we agreed to concrete dialogue, and I would say, more than just kind of nebulous commitments to continue to talk, this is an official channel." The New York Times reports that two separate dialogues will be established. One, a working group that includes business representatives and will focus on commercial issues, the other a government information exchange on export control issues. Otherwise, however, the two sides repeated long-standing positions from which they did not budge. The U.S. assuring China it is not decoupling their economies and wants better treatment of U.S. investors, China criticizing the U.S. for overstretching notions of national security to justify high-tech export controls. One other notable event, the Americans traveled from Beijing to Shanghai in a high-speed electric train that exceeds 200 miles an hour and can make the trip in under 5 hours. Studying Mandarin is no longer fashionable. Once upon a time, studying Chinese was all the rage, but as The Economist is reporting, that era is long gone. In the U.S. and several other countries, enrollment in Chinese language classes is way down, just when you would expect it to be rising. The bigger story here is even more unsettling. As U.S. schools cut back programs and teachers, the main victims are in the humanities, including foreign languages other than Spanish. The recent West Virginia University cuts to its World Languages and Literatures program may be the future. It's a narrow-minded approach that, according to the Economist article, seems to rest in part on the view that computer and cell phone programs can speak for us in a foreign language. As a Chinese speaker myself, I can tell you that if you really want to engage with people abroad, relying on a machine will not cut it. China's actual COVID deaths. Epidemiologists and other observers of China's experience with COVID agree that between December 2019, when the first outbreaks were officially reported, and December 2022, when the government ended its zero COVID restrictions, deaths from the disease were remarkably low. China's official account in those 3 years was a not very believable 86,000. In any case, a new study estimates that, quote, 1.87 million excess deaths occurred among individuals 30 years and older in China during the first 2 months after the end of its zero COVID policy. Excess deaths predominantly occurred among older individuals and were observed across all provinces in mainland China except Tibet, end quote. The scientists arrived at that figure by extrapolating from reported excess deaths around China and at three universities. In short, the end of COVID restrictions produced an immediate surge in the disease. What this and other studies suggest is that, contrary to official Chinese statements about COVID deaths, between December 2019 and now, as many as 3 million people died. One wonders if Beijing will ever offer a realistic figure that either affirms or contradicts the 3 million figure. Human rights in retreat in Afghanistan. When the Taliban took over Afghanistan in 2021, its leaders promised to respect women's rights, quote, within the framework of Sharia. That promise has come to mean drastically restricting women's rights and opportunities on religious grounds. PBS Frontline reports, quote, women and girls have been barred from attending high school and university, and human rights advocates fear that primary school may be next. Although women are only allowed to be seen by female healthcare professionals, the Taliban has also banned women from taking medical school exams. Women have been barred from entering public spaces like gyms, parks, and public baths. They are required to follow a strict dress code and aren't allowed to travel more than 46 miles without a male chaperone. Women's employment has also been limited since they are no longer allowed to work in the offices of non-governmental organizations and have been excluded from holding positions in public office. U.S. diplomatic efforts continue, but there's been no significant breakthrough for either side. The Taliban's main demands include international recognition, lifting of sanctions, and access to frozen foreign exchange reserves. The U.S. and its partners insist on counterterrorism commitments, an inclusive government, and restoring rights for women and girls. The United States might again be storing nuclear weapons in Britain. A careful review of a recent U.S. Air Force budget request indicates that construction will begin next year of a storage facility for nuclear weapons in Britain, a Royal Air Force base only about 100 kilometers from London. It would be the first time in 15 years that U.S. nukes have been stored there. Pentagon budgeting also provides for upgrading nuclear storage facilities, called surety dormitories in Pentagonese, in five other NATO member countries, but the latest budget documents removes all the countries' names. I have to ask, why, in the midst of a war on the continent, would the U.S. make such a provocative and strategically questionable move? How many nuclear bombs will be located at the British base? The Pentagon refuses to say. Is the U.S. signaling that it considers nuclear war with Russia a possibility? Or does it think stationing more nuclear weapons in Europe deters Russia's use of a nuclear weapon in Ukraine? The Russian ruble takes a hit. In a lengthy war such as Ukraine's, you can only insulate society from it for so long. At some point, the costs start to come home, in body bags, the supermarket, employment. So it is with Russia. Although on the surface life appears to be normal, at least in Moscow, we do see how the weakening ruble is pushing up prices and, more significantly, forcing Vladimir Putin to face difficult choices. There are several causes of the ruble's lower value. Western sanctions are biting, Russian military spending is ballooning, and thus Putin's budget deficit is growing very large. Putin can no longer count on energy exports to Europe or on borrowing to finance the budget deficit. Anders Aslund, a Russia expert in Europe, writes, quote, the Russian president faces the choice between tanking the ruble or limiting his rearmament. My suspicion is that Putin is so afraid of the political unrest that a financial crisis could cause that he would rather reduce his arms production than risk letting the ruble fall to 200 rubles per dollar, end quote. The ruble exchange rate was 96 to the U.S. dollar on September 1. Not yet a crisis, but uncomfortable for the Russian leader. Finally, new space achievements and failures. On the achievement side is India, which is becoming a space power. The moon rover of India's Chandrayaan-3 recently exited the spacecraft to begin exploration of the inner South Pole. Days later, India launched another spacecraft to study the outer atmosphere of the sun. Meanwhile, North Korea's second attempt to place a spy satellite in orbit failed, but space authorities vowed to try again in October. The satellite launch prompted an angry debate in the UN Security Council, with the US and other representatives arguing that North Korea once again had violated the ban on ballistic missile tests. The North Korean representative said his country had a sovereign right to launch satellites and again rejected the UN ban. Russia's delegate backed him up, saying the U.S. was the real source of threats to international peace and security. China agreed, citing U.S. deployment of a nuclear submarine to South Korea in July. But the U.S. representative countered that the deployment, unlike North Korea's ballistic missile launches, is not prohibited by the Security Council. Evidently, neither side mentioned North Korea's nuclear-capable cruise missiles, which it is also testing and which is not under a UN ban. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks very much for listening. Take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking with the president and CEO of the Urban League of Portland, Nkenge Harmon-Johnson. Thank you for coming on Cable News in Depth with us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
So today we're talking all things Urban League, everything you've been up to in the past month and what's upcoming here. So let's jump in. Back on August 19th, the Urban League of Portland hosted the Back to School Braidout and Resource Fair. What can you tell me about that? What was that all about?
Oh, it's another exciting Urban League event. Every quarter or so, we have a resource fair for the community. It's our chance to bring folks together, to offer housing resources, job resources, all the things the Urban League has in one place for people to walk up and benefit from. And we've been throwing a twist onto these events to make sure that they're even more fun. And this time around, back in August, like you mentioned, we did the Back to School Braidout, and that was a chance for us to make sure that kids could get a fresh new haircut or braid style to go back to school, but also they could get backpacks full of school supplies, and we could deliver food boxes for their families. So it wasn't just one thing or the other. We had a variety of activities and offerings for people. And what's really cool is that we served more than 1,000 people that day. It was huge. I think 60 kids got new braid styles or haircuts, and that's always great because that can be a challenge for parents. And we really had a good time doing it.
Well, looking back at August as well, the Urban League also hosted a recap of the 2023 legislative session. That was on August 23rd. What were some of the takeaways from that conversation?
You know, we stay busy at the Urban League, and this was a very busy legislative year for us down in Salem. We have several full-time lobbyists working on behalf of the African-American and Black community across Oregon. And we had a lot of fighting to do on a lot of issues that matter to our community. After all of that work, it's important to us that we come back and tell the community how things went, what we did, what went well, what we still have to fight for in following sessions. So that's what our Voices United legislative debrief is all about. And this time around, we added in some legislative champion awards. So I'd love to talk to you a little bit about those too.
Sure, go for it.
We spent, we tracked more than 100 bills this past session. Our advocacy team is led by Jennifer Parrish Taylor. She's the director, and her folks testified every single week. I offered testimony written and oral on a variety of bills, everything from affordable housing to criminal justice-related issues to education issues. We really were tracking, like I said, more than 100 bills that were important to the community that we serve. Well, in order to move legislation, you have to work with the people who have the votes, and that's our state legislators, both in the House and the Senate. And the great thing about the Urban League of Portland is, I always tell folks, in spite of our name, that we've had for nearly 80 years now, we serve a region. That's all of Oregon and Southwest Washington. So our constituents are certainly in the Portland metro area, but they're also in Salem. They're in Bend. They're in Medford. They're in Hood River, all across the state. So we engage with legislators all across the state. I guess fortunately, the issues that we touch upon are statewide issues. Affordable housing isn't just a problem in North and Northeast Portland. It's a problem in Deschutes County too. It's a problem in Ashland too. So when we talk to legislators, we talk to legislators from all over the place to share our views with them, but also to encourage them to vote in support of some of the most important and impactful bills that we track. Well, this time around, we also highlighted legislative champions. And those champions are members of the House and of the State Senate that really took some leadership on an issue that was important to the Urban League. We hadn't done this in quite some time. In fact, this is the first time during my tenure that we've celebrated legislative champions. But the Urban League has a strong tradition of legislative engagement. One of our former board members is the Honorable Senator Abel Gordley. One of my predecessors as president at the Urban League of Portland is the Honorable Margaret Carter. So we know what it is to engage and to care about state legislative action. And this was a way for us to show those legislators that we understand when they show up to fight on behalf of the Urban League. That was a really cool wrinkle that we added this time. And we celebrated Representative Travis Nelson from House District 44. He won the Freshman of the Year Award for all the work that he does for his North Portland district. We also celebrated Senator Deb Patterson. She's represents District 10 in Salem, South Salem. I think Senator Przanski, Senator Floyd Przanski represents District 4, and he covers Springfield and Eugene and also received the Senate Award. And it's a nonpartisan activity. The Urban League is a nonpartisan organization. You can be a Democrat, a Republican, a Green, independent party, unaffiliated, and we still want you to fight alongside us. So we were really excited to honor Representative Charlie Conrad. His district is House District 12 in Eastern Lane County, and he was celebrated with a House Award. We offered the inaugural Midge Purcell Award to recognize two of our legislative champions who demonstrated ambition and courage and really engaging not only with the Urban League, but on the issues that matter to us most. So we celebrated Senator Casey Jama from Portland with the Midge Purcell Award, and also Representative Janelle Bynum from House District 39 at Clackamas. They were the inaugural recipients of the award. It was a really special evening that we had more than 100 folks tuned in virtually. They were watching on Facebook and on YouTube. Just hear about not only these great legislators, but also the legislative agenda that the Urban League was fighting for.
Were there things from that conversation that inform what the Urban League is looking towards in the 2024 short session?
Definitely. But we were excited to pass some additional affordable housing legislation to create additional resources to help people in their homes, to help people avoid eviction. We were also really excited to see some of the developments on the criminal justice side of things, specifically related to creating more support for those attorneys who serve people who can't afford attorneys in Oregon. But there's a lot more work to do on that front. Oregon is still 1,000 attorneys short. We don't have enough public defenders in the state, and there's going to be a lot more work that we need to do. One example is providing student loan forgiveness for attorneys. I went to law school years ago. It was expensive then. Well, it's nearly three times expensive these days. So it's not uncommon for people to come out of law school with more than $100,000 in loans. Well, if we're asking folks who have that kind of debt to sign up to serve Oregonians to meet our constitutional obligation, we have to help them with that burden, or they won't take on these jobs and we'll still continue to have this deficit. So the legislature did some work to move the dial, but not enough. We're going to go back and fight for some additional resources. And then I think we've got a lot of work to do on environmental justice and food insecurity, too. So we did tell people about some of the wins and then pointed them in the direction to focus on what comes next for the short session in 2024.
Lots to look forward to. Well, looking ahead to the rest of September, the Urban League of Portland will be holding a community conversation at the Pendleton Roundup on September 15th. What will that conversation entail?
Oh my goodness, we're so excited to be going back to Pendleton for Roundup. You know, I started going to Roundup with my family when I was a kid, and I love rodeo. It's an important tradition in the West. It's also an important tradition in African-American culture. Cowboys and cowgirls have been black folks since cowboys and cowgirls existed. But the movies and TV shows have written us out of that sort of history. So the Urban League does this placemaking activity to take folks who might not otherwise feel comfortable going to rodeo out to Roundup. It's the arena. It's the biggest outdoor rodeo in the world, which is super impressive. People come from more than 13 states to participate in our Pendleton Roundup. And it makes sense that people from other parts of Oregon would experience it too. But too often what we hear from black folks is that, yeah, I'm interested, but I'm afraid to go out there by myself. or I'm not sure how my family would be treated when we go out to Eastern Oregon. So we'd love to, but we're not sure about going on our own. So this time around, rather than the half dozen folks that the Urban League is usually able to take, we're taking dozens of people and families to Eastern Oregon next week to experience Roundup. It's the biggest undertaking we've done like this, but we think it's time to help emerge from the pandemic, to celebrate all that Oregon has to offer, and really give folks a chance to let her buck at the Roundup. So we'll be in the parade. This is a tradition of ours. We're in the parade every year, riding in a horse-drawn buggy, waving at folks and celebrating the Urban League and celebrating the Roundup tradition. We're also hosting a community conversation, as you mentioned, and that's a really special event that the Urban League has been doing all around the state. I think the last time you and I talked, we were headed out to Lincoln County for the Urban League community conversation there in Lincoln City. Well, this time around, our community conversation is going to be in Pendleton, and we have the chance to highlight Black history as it relates to Eastern Oregon, everything from the Triple Nickels, a famous paratrooper group that trained in Eastern Oregon, highlighting some of the great cowboys that have participated in at Roundup in history. And there's going to be an artist in town who's got a great installation in Eastern Oregon. It comes from the Snitzer family collection, Leonardo Drew. And he's going to be there himself, an African-American artist, with just really dynamic and powerful work. So folks are going to get to have a conversation about Black history in Eastern Oregon, to learn more about the fact that it's there, it's real, and then to hear about some of the present-day activities that relate to Black folks in Pendleton and Eastern Oregon. We're super excited about this conversation. So the number one thing for me is that folks will learn that Roundup is for them, too. You don't have to be from the country. You don't have to be from Eastern Oregon. You don't have to know how to ride a horse or, you know, flop a trot. None of that. But you can still really enjoy this fine tradition and be welcome and feel safe and learn some new things and relax. That's what I'm hoping that people will get out of this. Beyond that, there are a lot of Black folks who live in, you know, the Eastern Oregon, live in along the Idaho border, live in Walla Walla, more than you'd expect at least. And those community members are really delighted that we're coming over to engage and to bring other family, really, to celebrate. So I'm hoping that there'll be some light shown on Black and African communities, and for that matter, other communities of color that are in these rural areas where they might not be expected. We really want to show how they're thriving and how we're all connected. That's what our trip to Pendleton is about for the Urban League.
One of the other big upcoming events for your organization is the Equal Opportunity Day celebration that's coming up on September 28th. What can you tell me about that event?
So this year, our Equal Opportunity Dinner is coming back in person. Yep, back in person, y'all. The Urban League was very careful during the pandemic, and while we continue to take certain things, and you can come by the Urban League office and pick up KN95 masks or hand sanitizer, we still have those things available. You can still pick up home testing kits from the Urban League, because we really want people to protect themselves from COVID. We decided this year to bring our gala back in person. People miss the opportunity to come together, to rub elbows. So after a few years being only having this fundraiser digitally, we're going to be back at the Oregon Convention Center on September 28th. We're kicking off at 6 o'clock. I think our doors open at 5, and the reception starts then, and the program's going to start at 6 o'clock. And this is really a chance for community to come together and to celebrate the mission of the Urban League, and also their own efforts to increase opportunities for all of us in this region.
Who is the event for? Who do you hope comes?
This is an event that is really welcoming of community. We got to sell tickets and, you know, bring in the bucks. So we look forward to having our corporate sponsors there. We have nonprofit partners who participate in this activity, and certainly local government too. So it's a big variety of folks who come. Even better, though, we're able to host some of our program participants. So you'll see some of the people who benefit from the gifts that you're making if you decide to donate to our Equal Opportunity Gala. We'll have senior citizens there who participate in our elder program. I believe that we'll have youth and some young professionals who are present who are Urban League volunteers or receive after-school programming from us. So it's a real chance for people who donate to the Urban League to hear directly from people who benefit from those donations, and even beyond that, to meet the Urban League staff. Our staff will be at this event, will be the hosting folks. We'll actually have tables set up around the room during the reception where people can come up and learn about our housing work. Folks can move to another table and learn about our workforce and education efforts in the community, or they can visit our health staff and hear directly from the people who are providing services. This is really a great chance to learn about your Urban League and to ask questions directly to the people who are responsible for delivering services while making a donation in support of the work. Oh, and Althea, let me tell you, we also honor a real community champion during this event. And I'm so excited that this year's honoree is Portland's own Rekaya Adams, the Chief Executive Officer of the 1803 Fund and a homegirl right from North and Northeast Portland. She is our honoree this year. And I really hope that people who love Rekaya, who respect her work and who look forward to seeing her continue to help people thrive in our community will come out to support her for the gala on the 28th.
Very cool. Well, if folks are interested in learning more about your work at the Urban League or these upcoming events, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to learn more about us and to get connected with our events is to visit our website. We're at ulpdx.org. That's ulpdx.org/events. That'll take you right to our events page, and you can learn more about Equal Opportunity Dinner. You can find out how to sponsor it there. You can find out how to buy a ticket there. Or if you can't come and you just want to make a donation, there's also the opportunity to do that. Anyone who wants to learn more about any of these activities, including our roundup activity, could also get in touch via email. Email us at development@ulpdx.org, and we will get right back to you with whatever details you might want. Those are the handiest ways to get in touch with the League.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up here?
As you can tell, I'm super excited about the Urban League work.